welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of this Thursday edition of the Hagmann Report. We are joined by our guest, James Wesley Rawls, and it's great to have him back. He's an internationally recognized authority on family disaster preparedness and survivalism. His website is survivalblog.com. It's a very popular survival blog on the internet, and it was one of the first on the internet as well. Mr. Rawls, welcome back to the Hagmann Report.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. There's so much in the news right now, and we didn't get a chance to really coordinate before the show, so I'm going to just kind of throw this out at you. Where do you want to start tonight?
Well, I guess all eyes are still on Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And folks are really wondering about Stephen Paddock and his motivations, what connections he might have, and really the agenda behind the events.
Well, what's, you know, I've said this for the last 2 days, that we see an abundance of information about Stephen Paddock out there, but not a lot of it really relevant to a motive or what is the cause or reason that he carried out these acts. We've learned, you know, that he was a very reclusive type person, at least in his home and domestic life, and also that he liked the casinos and liked the gamble. He was a wealthy man, but not much, I mean, and a little bit of work history, but not much about what led him to carry out the, you know, the biggest mass shooting in American history. And do you have any thoughts on this? What might have driven him? Have you seen anything that sparks your interest?
Sure. There's several things that come to mind immediately. First and foremost is he is a private pilot who owns two airplanes. Mm-hmm. And all of my life experience in dealing with private pilots is that once someone gets a general aviation license, they tend to gear their lives and build their mindset around general aviation. And for someone who had that extensive a background in aviation and such a limited background in firearms, I'm really surprised that if he decided in a meticulous, pre-planned way to carry out this attack, why he didn't do it with an aircraft he already owned or an aircraft that he could transition to, whether he could rent it or buy it. But the man was a millionaire. He could have bought himself a fairly large twin-engine plane, something like on the order of a Beechcraft Super King Air or maybe even something even larger. And even if he had not laden that aircraft with extra fuel and explosives, he still could have killed far more than 59 people simply by doing a landing gear up landing right on that crowd of people.
That's a great point.
He could have killed probably 200 or 300 people before that plane came to a stop, maybe even more, because it was a crowd of 20,000 people. And any decently skilled pilot could execute a gear-up landing somewhere in that crowd and done tremendous damage. And if he had wanted to plan it even further, he could have packed an airplane with explosives and killed several hundred people, maybe, you know, 600 or 700 people, if he wanted to do it that way. So I've really got to wonder, since he has such a strong background in aviation, why he didn't do an aviation-type attack. And there was a attack on an IRS building back east more than a decade ago with a gentleman about his same age who was a tax protester. And that would have fit the model of someone, the mindset of someone who had a general aviation ticket. So that was the first thing that popped into my mind when I heard that he had a pilot's license and that he owned two airplanes already.
Mr. Rawls, that is an exceptional insight. John Robertson sitting in for Doug Hagmann this evening, by the way. Doug is up to his eyeballs in investigating this tragedy in Las Vegas. The Northeast Intelligence Network has been very busy since Sunday evening when this event occurred. Mr. Rawls, with your permission, having read all of your books and in many cases given so many copies of many of the Patriot series away as gifts over the years, for our listeners' benefit, I'm just going to take a quick moment to shade in a little bit of your background, because I'd like to ask you some fairly technical questions and ask your opinion about some of the issues regarding the firearms that they supposedly found in the room. Our guest, folks, is James Wesley Rawls, who served as a commissioned officer in the Army. He was a captain in the U.S. Army and served in an intelligence unit. And if I remember correctly, it's been a while since I've heard this part of your bio, sir, but one of the things that our guest was responsible for back in the early to mid-80s was looking at the fragility factor, if you will, of Central and South American countries. And I will remind our listeners and viewers that this is during the Reagan era, when at any moment El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, any of these countries could have been the first domino to fall in sort of a Vietnam fashion. And our guest, James Wesley Rawls, as a captain in the U.S. Army, was responsible for looking at all kind of criteria in these countries that would suggest whether or not or how susceptible they would be to communism, looking at things like calories consumed per day, number of generations in a single domicile, more obvious things like number of vehicles owned, etc. So our guest has extensive knowledge in intelligence and an intelligence background, and he has written a series, a five-book series, the Patriot series, which I cannot recommend highly enough for anyone who is preparedness-minded. The five-book series is a must-read. It is a top-shelf series, again, by our guest, James Wesley Rawls. He's also written a couple of nonfiction books, How to Survive the End of the World as We Know It, a must-read for preparedness-minded people, and a recent book the title escapes me, Mr. Rawls. It's about having the proper tools for preparation.
Right. So, tools for survival. Also from Penguin Books.
Thank you so much. So, and thank you for giving me the opportunity just to kind of shade in your bio a little bit, because one of the reasons we were excited to bring you on tonight, when you read the Patriot series, for example, you clearly have a very good understanding of the basic firearm platforms, not just U.S. manufactured, but really manufactured stuff from all over the world. And in your writing, you write extensively about weapons platforms that can be purchased over the counter, so to speak, as well as things that are available only to law enforcement, special forces, etc. A couple of questions, Mr. Rawls. First of all, why 23 weapons, 23 long guns? Number two, do you buy this whole bump stock story? And number three, how did this guy get this much ammo up into the room, and how many shots would he have had to get off to wound over 500 people?
Yeah, well, to back up just a little bit, I think the 500-plus casualties figure, some of those were probably not attributed to gunshot wounds, but being trampled by the crowd trying to get out of that arena. So perhaps 400 people might have been wounded, and that ratio is believable given 5.56 bullets arriving at over 400 yards, where they've already lost about half their energy. So there would be a lot more wounding than full-on casualties. Basically, with 5.56 at that range, with either a 55-grain or 62-grain bullet, unless the chest cavity or the spinal column of the head is hit, then you're going to end up with some traumatic wounds, but not deaths. So the ratio of 58 to, say, 400 is believable. Now, as for, you asked about the bump fire stocks, there are several brands on the market. The one in the photograph that was surreptitiously released looks like a slide fire brand, second generation bump fire stock. And it's possible that if he had trained extensively with that stock, he might have been able to get off really long, extending a bump fire stock, have it tend to stutter quite a bit, where you'll get off just a few rounds, and then maybe perhaps a string of 20 or 30, and then another stutter, and you know, it really varies in terms of how many rounds you can get off without an interruption. But if you listen to the audio that accompanied the video of the shooting attack, at least the one string that I heard sounded like in excess of 80 rounds continuous at cyclic rate with no interruption whatsoever. So that tells me either that he was actually shooting a converted semi-auto with the seven magic parts, or he had trained extensively with a bump fire stock to get off long strings like that. But I'm still kind of incredulous. Also, the numbers kept getting inflated. At first we were told there were six guns in the hotel room. Then we were told there were 14 guns in the hotel room. Then there were, what was it, 19 or 20. And now we're told well in excess of 20 guns in the hotel room. And originally we were told there were two bump fire stocks. Then we were told there were six bump fire stocks. Now we're being told there were 12 bump fire stocks found in the room. And why just one man would feel he needed to bring 12 guns equipped with bump fire stocks to carry out a single-handed attack leaves me really scratching my head.
And James, let me jump in here just real quick to mention this. There were several, from what I understand and read, there were several fully loaded magazines in the room, but also the amount of firepower left many people asking, instead of switching magazines from the guns, was he just moving from one gun to the other? But what you're talking about with the sustained rate of fire, it's hard to imagine, because there were no 100-round drums up there. That, from what we saw, there were only, 30-round magazines?
Well, no, there were longer than 30-round magazines. At least the one pictured magazine was at least a 60-round Surefire magazine, which is actually a very unusual quadruple column magazine that's tapered. And outwardly, it looks like a 30 or 40 round magazine, but if you look carefully at the photo, you'll see it's a very thick magazine. The Surefire magazines are made in 60 and 100 round capacity, although it looked like the one in the photograph was actually a 60 rounders. So it's possible that he was using 100 round Surefire magazines. Or if he had half a brain, he would probably use Beta C magazines, which is a double snail drum 100-round magazine, because they're more reliable than Surefire magazines.
Yes, Mr. Rawls, quickly, with regard to the 100-rounders, and the second one you just mentioned, and I've personally fired these a few times, can you please tell us the name again? They tend to look like a figure eight, sort of.
It's made by the Beta Company, and its formal name is a C-MAG. That's a capital C-MAG, C standing for the Roman numeral for 100.
Okay, and so with that...
Double snail drum magazine that doesn't extend below the receiver of an AR-15 any more than about a 30-round magazine. They're fairly compact, and they're very reliable, and they're only slightly more expensive than a Surefire magazine. I'm really surprised he didn't source those instead of Surefire magazines.
Well,
when all is said and done, when they do finally do the perp walk type layout of everything that he had, that we see some Beta magazines there.
Well, last question on that, and then we can go wherever you like with the time that you have available for us this evening, Mr. Rawls. But with the C-Mags, the Beta C-Mags, I've bump fired a couple times in my life. Would the weight of 100 rounds of 5.56 223 ammo in that Beta C-Mag, would the weight of that compromise the bump fire stock capability? For those not familiar with bump firing, the weight would affect it, would it not?
To an extent, and in fact, it would make it more difficult to get off 100 round string. But again, if he practiced extensively, and also what's really odd is all the rifles that we've been shown are equipped with bipods, but anyone who's ever fired a slide fire bump stock knows you really can't use one from a bipod effectively, because you need to simultaneously have a forward pressure on the forend and a backward pressure on the stock to achieve a continuous string of bump fire. And using a bipod from a rest actually makes it more difficult to do. It's actually better done standing up or kneeling. So the other kind of hard to calculate factor is the fact that he was shooting downwards at a 30 or 40 degree angle, which unless he practiced with that from a hillside somewhere, would have made it difficult for him to achieve a long string of bump fire uninterrupted. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and a lot, you kind of almost, it's like almost like watching a fictional movie and having to suspend disbelief. That's the situation we're in right now with all the technical aspects of the firearms that were used. Now, we may find out later that he had illegally converted an AR-15 to full auto, which is my original suspicion, or that he had trained extensively with a slide fire stock. But even still, I really have my doubts that he, A, carried this out entirely by himself, and B, that the equipment that we've been shown so far, at least, matches the audio from that incident. It doesn't add up. It's not quite to the level of a JFK situation where, you know, you can't fire a Carcano bolt action rapid fire like it was done in the attack on John F. Kennedy, but it's almost to that level of incredulity.
Okay, and James, I want to get into some of what we saw with the police response, and you know, we know that it took, the shooting lasted for approximately 10 minutes, but it took the police 70 plus minutes.
Yeah.
And then I want to get into the ambulance and the actual concert venue and some of the inconsistencies there with the exits being blocked and the lack of ambulances even after the shooting stopped and EMT workers in there. But yeah, let's start with the police response.
Well, the police response, I think, may have been just simple timidity. And the same thing happened with the Pulse nightclub attack in Orlando, Florida, a year ago, where the police were too timid to charge in and try to confront this guy. Even though the security guard had already apparently unlocked the door from the outside with a master electronic key. So apparently the door inside was blocked with a chair or two, but nothing that would have stopped them. They very timidly waited and consulted amongst themselves, and then they brought in a full-on SWAT team, and then that SWAT team fiddled around with not one but two different explosive charges to breach the doors. I think perhaps they were timid because they were expecting a large volume of fire coming from the room if they charged in, or they were expecting explosive devices, a booby trap type device, if they simply charged into the room. I think that is a good enough explanation of why it took them 70 minutes. And given the fact there wasn't any shooting coming from the room for 60 of those 70 minutes, I can certainly understand their timidity. If the shooting had continued, if they had still hesitated, then I would have been horribly disappointed with them. But I think their timidity is understandable.
Yeah, and then they, I don't know if you saw the reports of the security guard who approached the door first, and the shooter Paddock had apparently up to three cameras, one in the hallway, one in the peephole, and another that he was apparently wearing when he carried out the attack. But there were reports that the security guard approached the door and was met by hundreds of rounds of fire, but the door really didn't indicate that. I don't even think the door would be there if it went through hundreds of rounds of fire, but the security guard was shot in the leg, and then they blew the doors off and entered, stating that they found the man dead, and we learned today that he had an extensive escape route plan, and I haven't seen what that was yet. But
I haven't heard of the details on that either, but if anything, that unarmed security guard showed a lot more guts than the police officers did. So his attempt to enter the room apparently is what got Stephen Paddock to panic and shoot himself, because he still had a lot more ammunition and guns he had never even fired. Now, I could see why he would bring two or three guns, all identically equipped, in the anticipation that one of them might jam with that high volume of fire. So that's believable. Why he would bring a dozen AR-15s, all converted with bump fire stocks, absolutely baffles me. Was he planning to have Confederates with him and have, and you'll notice he knocked out the glass from two different windows. Was he planning to have three or four shooters firing simultaneously? That actually matches the logistics that he'd lay in. Now, you asked earlier about how he managed to get that many guns and ammunition into the hotel. There, I think that he simply skipped having a bellhop involved at all and carried his own bags upstairs or wheeled them upstairs. They looked like they were rolling luggage. So that's believable. He could have done that, and he was there for 3 days. So he could have done that very gradually over a period of time and not attracted a lot of suspicion. Also, these were long guns, but they were all in the AR family, meaning that they can be disassembled simply by pushing two pivot pins and breaking them down. Where if with a 16-inch barrel and 8 inches of receiver, you won't end up with any. The longest single component would have been about 22 or 23 inches long, which would have fit fairly easily, at least laid diagonally into most large rolling luggage. So that's believable.
Yeah, and, you know, we saw a receipt released, actually from the police said he checked in on the 28th. We saw a room receipt from the 27th where there was dining for two, in-room dining for two. So he was there a number of days, and I believe over a period of a few days, you could easily, you know, even just one gun at a time, the amount of times you go back up and forth to your room could have got those weapons up there. It's not like he carried it all up in one big trip.
No. It could have been done very gradually over the course of 3 days and not attracted a lot of suspicion. I'm just wondering who John Doe number one is.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you make the point that the number of weapons and the logistics that he could have, or maybe even had, you know, a second or third person involved or wanted to at least, that's much more plausible than him carrying up, you know, two dozen weapons for his own personal use during that shooting.
Yeah, even with the anticipation of, you know, a gun melting down or a gun jamming, having stoppages with that insane level of fire, which really an AR-15 is not designed for. You know, he was basically using an AR in a squad automatic role. That role with a very high volume of fire is better suited to a belt fed like an M249,
or Mr. Rawls,
with a Shrike upper.
And it's interesting you would say that, because Sergeant Joe Biggs, formerly of InfoWars, tweeted out day before yesterday. I'm not going to be able to get it verbatim, but I'll paraphrase. It said to effect, "My military buddies and I believe this to be a squad, you know, a 240 squad automatic weapon." Again, Joe Biggs on Twitter day before yesterday. But there's another question I want to ask you. I'm just curious, because you have such unique verisimilitude in your expertise, as demonstrated in your writing. And going back to your first fictional book, Patriots, one of the things I loved about the book is you set up this great cast of characters, and you talk extensively about the upgrades they do to their home in Idaho, and it for DIY type people, you really go into some incredible detail. I remember the talking about the construction of the doors and reinforcing the windows and the points of access and egress, etc. And for that reason, reminiscent of those chapters in Patriots, Mr. Rawls, I want to ask your opinion about actually knocking the holes in the glass on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel. Now, Joe Hagman and I... Yeah, go ahead. I mean, what's your take on it, sir?
I actually have to claim ignorance on that. Now, in one of the photos that was released, it looks like there's a rescue or safety hammer laying on the floor, a bright colored hammer. And even with laminated glass and with the Mandalay Bay Tower, it looks like they used an outer gold mylar film over the windows. And or either inner or outer, I would assume outer for that high reflectivity. I don't think it's any great stretch of the imagination to think that he could have knocked those windows out himself. The other thing that kind of baffles me is the one window from which he was supposedly firing was completely knocked out. If he wanted to kill himself, why couldn't he have just continued firing until he heard signs of someone entering the room and simply just jumped out the window? He could have kept firing much longer. So if this man was a total cold-blooded psychopath, like we're told, then why wouldn't he opt for that option? Because he still had hundreds of rounds of ammunition in loaded magazines available to shoot. It just doesn't fit. There's a lot of things that just don't add up, in my estimation.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It doesn't add up. Why, with the amount of firepower you have in the room, why stop shooting after only the first 10 minutes, especially when you had an additional hour? I mean, just as you said, there is a lot here that doesn't add up, and the abundance of information we're receiving is not really important to the plot. Although it is important to the overall narrative, it's not really important to the plot that we're seeing. And you also have the strange occurrence of somebody 45 minutes before the shooting took place in the crowd saying that you're all going to die. Then you had
That might have just been someone who was panicky, who was worried about the density of the crowd. It's someone who had agoraphobia, for example.
Okay, does that happen? Have you we've heard cases like this before?
That's believable, although that coincidence is a little odd. I'd like to kind of diverge and talk about the Hegelian dialectic here for a minute.
Sure.
If the goal here, if he was a mind control subject, or if he was a trained ISIS follower, or if he was someone who wanted to carry out an attack like the one on Washington, D.C. that very seriously injured Congressman Scalise, why was it that he was so heavily armed with just small arms? Why didn't he use his aviation background? And it seems almost like he was a poster child for gun control because of the number of guns, and they were all AR-15s or AR-10s. He had a dozen bump fire stocks. It's like if someone wanted to have a wind-up toy, a mind control subject, used for the political goal of banning bump fire stocks, I can't think of a better setup than what he was providing, because it was like almost like it was a set piece arrangement to say, aha, here are these evil large capacity magazines, and here are these evil bump fire stocks. They need to be banned. You couldn't have set it up any better. So I wonder, we don't know.
Especially, Mr. Rawls, thank you so much for standing up and stating it exactly as you see it. We would be remiss if we didn't remind our listeners that there were not one but two pieces of legislation, one before the House, that of course being the one that the legislation involving silencers, the availability thereof, etc. And then, of course, there's the, I don't believe it had actually made it to bill status yet, but the NRA proposal for 50-state reciprocity of the concealed carry. And, of course, basically all of us who voted for President Trump really would love to see that reciprocity of concealed carry.
There was also a petition campaign that was leading up to legislation that would have completely canceled out the National Firearms Act of 1934. All three of those pieces of legislation or potential legislation have now, of course, been completely sidetracked. And if anything, we're probably going to see a retrograde where we end up with legislation that's going to end up either banning high-capacity magazines or banning bump fire stocks, or perhaps with the piece of legislation that Senator Feinstein just offered. It was so loosely worded, even a match trigger, a light trigger, for an AR would be banned because it could conceivably be considered something that could accelerate the rate of fire versus a standard AR-15 trigger. So that would affect virtually all Geissele triggers, match triggers, binary triggers, FosTec triggers, and of course all the add-ons like bump fire stocks and hellfire triggers, and all that whole panoply would not be just banned from further production, but banned from ownership, where people would literally have to turn them in for destruction. And the it flies right in the face of American jurisprudence that the wording of Senator Feinstein's bill doesn't even allow for compensation for that unconstitutional taking. Whenever you take someone's, if you ban something and force someone to turn it in, under American jurisprudence, typically there is a mechanism for reimbursing someone for that loss. Otherwise, it's a federal taking.
You know, Mr. Rawls, your writing is so prescient and proves to this day to be so prescient. Having written, I believe, Patriots in 1993-94, if I'm not mistaken, I'd like...
I actually have to point, if you want to talk prescience, I have to point you...
Please.
...to Matt Bracken and his series of novels, especially his first novel titled Enemies Foreign and Domestic. And that novel, in the first chapter, opens with an attack from long range on a stadium by someone who is he's actually a patsy. If you're going to talk prescience, please don't try to credit me. I think real credit belongs to Matt Bracken.
It is kind of you to say so. And so apropos, because our third hour guest this evening is none other than Matt Bracken, because
fantastic.
Mr. Rawls, I too read Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. I read all three of his books, and we are certainly going to get his commentary on exactly what you just beautifully set up for us. So thank you for that. What I wanted to ask you, and I know you have just a few minutes left with us, sir, but how much more do you think the American people are going to put up with? We were just talking about a perceived possible gun grab. Feinstein's been at this forever. In your books, you craft characters who are always decent and reasonable. They tend to be Christian in all different walks of faith, different denominations, etc. But they tend to be, in my opinion, they tend to demonstrate reasonable, decent, traditional Americans. And that's one of the things I like about your work. But many of your characters hit a point where they say, enough is enough. I've seen the First, Second, Fourth Amendment, Tenth Amendment trampled enough. This is the line. We go no further from here. What are your thoughts moving forward, Mr. Rawls?
Well, unfortunately, given our media-driven society, I don't expect that most Americans are going to reach a revulsion point before they end up behind barbed wire. We have been living under the gradual expansion of federal power ever since the Civil War. The two most rapid periods of expansion, of course, were during the Civil War itself and during the Great Depression of the 1930s, when all the alphabet soup agencies got started. But we've been so gradually enslaved, I think that unless there is a monumental trigger event like the declaration of martial law and a roundup of privately owned firearms by federal decree, unless there was a huge trigger event like that, I'm afraid that most Americans are not going to reach a revulsion point, and they're simply going to go passively into the night, as it were.
Yeah, you know, that's always, you know, we always see a huge amount of the American public that just about will do anything the government says to a degree, and you wonder, you know, how trusting, that level of trust that the American people have had with the government historically seems to be getting lower and lower as the years move forward. But, you know, there are still massive amounts of people that do. And interestingly enough, whatever happened in Las Vegas or whatever was supposed to happen, one of the points I want to make on the gun control issue is that even a number from Steve Scalise, who was the victim of his own shooting in May, to a number of the victims from Las Vegas, they have flat out come out against the mainstream media narrative and, you know, said gun control is not the answer. And now right. We see, you know, the Congress going after the bump stock and other way modification ways to make semi-automatic guns, you know, fire as automatics, but they're not getting the response.
They're not truly automatic. They're actually just accelerated in a way that allows more rapid manipulation of the trigger, or in the case of binary trigger, legally allows a weapon to fire on the pull of the trigger and then the release of the trigger. So it's not truly fully automatic fire. The mass media is trying to make it sound like it's fully automatic, but it's not.
Okay. Well, back to the...
And just a little bit, you mentioned people reaching a revulsion point. I got to thinking last night as I lay in bed, 25 years ago, if someone were to tell me that people at airports would passively line up, subject themselves to full body scans, groping, removing their shoes, and having all their luggage gone through in the way they currently are, I would have said, oh, people have never put up with that. But here we are in the post 9/11 world, where people have very meekly gone down that slippery slope. And I think the next step will be TSA agents at bus stops and at train stations, and eventually to the point where there may be diversion of traffic from highways into roadside checkpoints with TSA goons groping people by on the roadside and searching through their cars without a warrant.
You know, Mr. Rawls, it is a sad state of affairs, and it's certainly a grim supposition that you make. Unfortunately, I'm in agreement with you, sir, and I think...
We're already seeing it at the casinos.
Exactly. What has happened, you used the term Hegelian dialectic earlier. I want to bounce another back your direction. I know you're familiar with it, and of course, that is the Overton window. And when a government becomes tyrannical and learns to create a problem, create the solution, and thus ultimately attain the goal that they set to begin with, which is typically one of greater control, greater tyranny, greater debt-driven society, etc., they always give the populace the sense of a false victory from time to time. Two steps forward, one step back. Three steps forward, two steps back. And whereas, again, I wish I could disagree with what you just said, having been a resident of four major cities in my life, and most recently Seattle and Los Angeles, they already have TSA that walk the public transportation environments in Los Angeles. And the level of invasive behavior that the average American will put up with at this time makes me sick.
I have to agree with you. We really need to pray that the American people will summon up enough collective backbone to say no if I'm afraid the Republican leadership in Congress, given the Paul Ryans of the world, I think are going to cave in, especially if President Trump mentions publicly that he's willing to sign legislation that would do X, Y, or Z, like banning bump fire stocks or banning large, actually full capacity magazines. We really need to have backbone, and we really need to have some kind of pushback on Congress. People need to speak up quite vociferously, or we're going to be down another step down the road toward tyranny.
James, if I can ask you this, I'm not sure how much you've seen about the alleged Antifa Day of Rage, November 4th, but do you see how we see the populist movements being used in Catalonia? One is one example where they just voted for their independence against Spain, and there are other examples in Europe where they're saying populist movements are going to be, you know, we're going to be seeing more of those, and a number of other countries are at risk of seeing themselves split from the European Union. Do you see the ability for the Antifa types, the left, to actually carry out this day of rage that they're trying to accomplish?
I do indeed, and in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of it is at arm's length, done primarily with cyber attacks. Because, let's face it, the majority of people who are involved in Antifa are millennials, and those are people who are quite savvy with computer programming, hacking type skills, and also because they tend to be fairly cowardly snowflake individuals, I think their preferred method will be cyber attacks. So it is quite possible that on November 4th or at some point in the next few years, we could see a coordinated cyber attack on large portions of our infrastructure, whether it's oil and natural gas pipelines, the electrical power grid, power generating stations, telecommunications, water treatment, water transport, any number of key pieces of infrastructure could be attacked simultaneously with zero-day style attacks with devastating effect. Also, don't underestimate the ability of these millennial Antifa terrorists to use off-the-shelf technologies like quadricopter drones and possibly using either chemical irritants, toxins, neurotoxins. They could use any number of different or small explosives to again be able to do a at arm's reach attack where they would have a good opportunity to escape detection and get away. So again, these off the shelf technologies are a considerable risk. And don't underestimate these people and their ability to use them. When you, especially if you look at fairly easy to formulate toxins, especially if they're mixed with a transdermal carrier like DMSO, you could have a very. We didn't have to be an explosive charge. It could just be a CO2 cylinder that's used to dispense a small cloud of a toxin that's mixed with DMSO, and you end up with anywhere from 20 to 200 people dead. And if you add the quadricopter drone technology, you could do that from a standoff distance, and that will make virtually all public events where you have large crowds at great risk. It's also going to mean the end of the traditional political speech at an open-air arena or large enclosed coliseum, for example. I think that will become a thing of the past in the next few years after the first Antifa attack using those off-the-shelf technologies.
Very, very interesting. James Wesley Rawls is our guest. His website is survivalblog.com. James, just want to ask you one last question on back to Las Vegas real quick. We saw that the shooter, Stephen Paddock, whether whatever his reasons for this were, I don't know, that he booked venues in Boston and Chicago, in Boston overlooking Fenway Park and Chicago overlooking the Lollapalooza type, or the Lollapalooza event. Do you think that we're going to see more of these types of attacks on open, you just mentioned that the open stadiums, open arenas, type events where people congregate in mass for these different events? Do you think we're going to see an increase?
I think that's very likely, because the whole goal of terror is to get the maximum bang for the buck. And if you can have a large number of people congregated in a fairly compact area, that provides what the military refers to as a target-rich environment. So I think they will indeed try that. I think the James Hodgkinson attack was just a precursor, and by the same token, the Stephen Paddock attack was just a precursor of things to come, perhaps on a grand scale. I've suggested in my blog that we may end up with a period of heightened terrorism, a lot like the late 1960s and the early 70s, with the draft protests that spawned domestic terrorism, with groups like the Weather Underground and the Sudanese Liberation Army and the Black Liberation Army. We could see a very similar time period here in the United States, and unfortunately, the response to that on the part of state and federal authorities could be far worse than the attacks themselves.
James, we have a question from a Maria W. in our email. She said she read an article that the perpetrator was a gun runner for the government and or possibly ISIS, and that ISIS may have taken advantage or radicalized him and were the actual ones to do the shootings. But she wants to know, would the guns that he had there be consistent with the kinds of guns in these types of weapon deals? Were there anything special about them? Were they common?
Not in particular. They're fairly common weapons. You know, the AR family of firearms has become so ubiquitous in the last 10 years that it's essentially like, you know, Barbie dolls for men, where you have unlimited opportunities to accessorize. And, no, they're truly modular guns. And it's an off-the-shelf technology. They're truly ubiquitous. Ever since the election of President Trump, their price point has dropped to ridiculous levels. You can actually buy a pretty nice AR-15, a full-up AR-15 with, you know, a chrome chamber or even a chrome bore, for under $350 right now. That,
wow.
During the Obama administration, that would have been a $1,350 rifle. So they're out there in large numbers. I actually am gratified to see so many in private circulation, because it makes it virtually impossible for the government to ever round them up. But in terms of him being a gun runner, I really doubt that. He really appears to have been a near genius level card sharp, where he, at least in terms of the game of poker, developed a mathematical system to fairly consistently earn a profit, which, you know, the casinos never like that. They don't like card counters, and they don't like people who rig the system. But someone with a decent head on their shoulders and some patience, and who has the ability to stay away from, you know, alcohol, can actually make some money at this. And I think he was an example of someone who had done that. His father was a diagnosed psychopath. I suspect he might have been as well. But we still haven't heard the real story. I would really like to hear and see the video that he supposedly took of his own tech. He apparently had a camera set up. I would like to hear what he was saying. I'd really like to hear if he was saying Allahu Akbar, or, you know, death to Trump and his compadres, or whatever. I want to hear what's on that video. I'd really like to know what he wrote in the note that is visible on the table in his room. Apparently, he left some sort of suicide note. I really want to see what was in that note. Are we ever going to be apprised of what was there, or is that information going to be suppressed? Because his psychological profile does not match the typical running amok or going postal profile where someone snaps and starts killing people on pretty short notice. He was very methodical, which to me looks like a well-planned terrorist incident, and the psychological profile that would match would be someone who's either politically motivated, like Hodgkinson, or religiously motivated, like Omar Mateen. So it remains to be seen, and I'm kind of waiting with bated breath to see what is released, because I don't think we've been told the whole story yet.
No, and I agree with you. And you know, the more that I look into his background, and the same information you just outlined, you know, you'd almost think the kind of person he was that he would be more conservative leaning, being a gun owner for a number of years, even though he only started amassing a huge quantity of guns in the last year, being somewhat independently wealthy for whatever reasons, whether it was legitimate or illegitimate, and but the fact that there is, I think there's a lot to what you're saying about the note, the body camera footage, and I think I would hope that would tell us a lot more than what we already know, because that's one of the things that I believe makes this such a frightening situation for the American people, is not having that intimate knowledge of what drove this man to do what he did, whether it could be the most extreme or minuscule excuse to us, you know, whether he was kicked off a blackjack table and just decided to go postal and set up this great big plan, or he felt wronged by, you know, whoever. That kind of closure does help the Americans and anybody really move on from this kind of event, but we don't have that yet. And until we have that, we're going to continue to have rampant speculation from ISIS to an anti-Trump person, and we're not going to know what to really make of it. And I think that in itself is dangerous.
Yes, I agree. Well, thank you so much for having me on as your guest. It's been a pleasure, and I hope that your listeners will pray about this and that they will remain politically active. We can't just be passive, and we don't want to roll over and play dead on this. We need to stick to our guns, literally, and make it clear to Congress that the Second Amendment is unequivocal.
Amen. Amen and amen. Our guest this hour, James Wesley Rawls, truly, in my humble opinion, one of the great statesmen, patriarchs, if you will, of the modern preparedness-minded movement. Certainly his books were instrumental in my red pill moment back in 2009. He is also the gentleman, by the way, who coined the term the American Redoubt, a region of inland northwest states that many independent-minded, conservative, constitution-loving, and God-loving Americans are choosing to relocate to. Joe, what a treat to have Mr. Rawls join us tonight.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mr. Rawls, thank you so much. Survivalblog.com is the website, and make sure you bookmark that and check it regularly. Thank you, Mr. Rawls.
Thank you so much, and God bless you and your listeners.
God bless you, too.
God bless you, sir.
We only have about 2 minutes left in this segment, so I want to take a minute to do this. This is something that we're going to... John, I know that you talked about this. We talked about this as a staff together, that we were going to start giving thank yous out on air to some of our donors. And I believe these were just picked at random. But just want to go through a few of these. This one is from Donna T. I enjoy your show so much. It's the first thing I turn on every morning and the last thing I listen to each night. Thank you, Donna T. And then there's a beautiful card, that is very nice. Also, we have one from Patty O. She says, God bless you both. You, your employees, your wives, your families, and your studio dogs. Where would we all be without you two? And then she goes on to compliment us and says she's learned so much about the Bible and the times we're in and trying to be prepared in all the ways and all the guests and everything they talk about, trying to prepare others the best way I know how. I can only say thank you for these gifts that you have given me. That from Patty O. Patty, thank you so much. And, you know, we would not be here without people like you. And this last one is from Michelle G. And Renee sent a thank you note back to her yesterday or yeah today, and she says, God bless you all. I'm praying for the Lord Jesus to touch you all and keep you well and safe. You are brave people. Your email brought tears. Have a blessed day. And that from Michelle G. And we just want to say thank you so much to the listeners who support our show, whether it's through spreading the word about the show, through prayer, through monetary donations. It would not be possible without your support. So we just want to take the time out to say thank you so much. And we're going to start doing more of these. I'm not sure if it's going to be on a daily basis, a weekly basis.
But
we're
going to
make sure that we, if we took our listener mail, we could fill up a whole table just from, we could fill up this whole big desk just from what we got this year, maybe even just, the last 3 months. It does come in pretty heavy at times, but it's a great thing, and it's a great feeling to have people out there that are praying for you and supporting us, and at the same time, they are learning about different subjects through our guests, through us. But either way, all of it's possible through the Lord, because as we say so often, we did not put ourselves here, and this was by the Lord's guidance, and we're going to continue to move in the direction that He guides us. But just want to say thank you to each and every one of you out there who support us. Again, we could not do this without you. When we come back, Matt Bracken will be our guest, so don't go anywhere.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.